So welcome back to the return of the Chronic Pain Club in 2023, and I'm delighted to be joined by good friend, patient advocate, allied health professional, and just all-round lovely person, Zoe Clark. Zoe, how are you? Welcome in.
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Obviously, I know you, and I know lots of people in our community know you from the messages I've received this week who were looking forward to seeing you. No pressure, by the way. But for anyone watching this back or watching it live that haven't come across what you do, do you want to just maybe give sort of overview about what you do, like for work and the advocacy side of things before we get into it?
Yeah, absolutely. So people probably know me mainly from the kind of inflammatory arthritis, axial spa, AS community. That's the main kind of advocacy work I do. I've had AS for coming up 12 years now, but it took around 7 years for me to get my diagnosis. It was quite a long journey. So that was my first step into the patient advocacy kind of side of things, working with NAS, the patient organization for people with that condition, and sharing my story of diagnosis to hopefully help change that for other people coming through now. But I also have a couple of other conditions. So I have hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I also have endometriosis and adenomyosis as well. So nice little collection going, and I'm happy to even talk about, I may be having a new diagnosis coming soon as well to add to that collection. So happy to talk about navigating that world.
I don't think we're yet to have a single person come on here talking about their chronic illness that's got just one. Like, it's very rare. And if they have got one, then they've only just been diagnosed. Unfortunately, these things do tend to come like buses. There's obviously, we've got quite a bit to go through that. And our audience love a sort of like diagnosis journey, not because they're morbid or anything, just because of that. It tends to be people hit those same blockers, and that knowing what they need to know, the questions they need to ask and everything to help them navigate their own journey. Where did it all start for you? And then maybe we'll tackle sort of maybe one condition at a time as you go through that.
That sounds sensible, yeah. So it all started when I was 20 and I was training in London. I was in my third year of a 4-year degree training to become an osteopath. So I was already kind of immersed in the medical world a little bit. And I initially started getting swelling in my ankles and my wrists and elbows. So it took a few months before I ended up seeing a rheumatologist. And we went sort of back and forth a few times. They were hoping it was just one of these weird types of arthritis that will just come on, you know, from an infection or something like that and would just disappear. But it didn't, unfortunately. And I ended up being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis to begin with. But gradually over time, I started getting more of the back pain that is really kind of classical with ankylosing spondylitis. But it was interesting because despite being in that medical world and kind of knowing the right things to ask and taking someone with me to appointments, it was still really difficult to get the right diagnosis. And it took 7 years in total to do that, and changing health professionals 3 times as well. So it was a long road, definitely. But that's my training. So I was lucky in a sense that having those symptoms start while I was training, I was able to get help in kind of adapting how I worked so that I was able to finish training and actually start practice as well.
And it was interesting you said 7 years, because isn't that about the sort of average time that people with AS are sort of waiting for diagnosis? Off the top of my head, please, you'll know this better than me, so please feel correct me if my facts are wrong.
Yeah, so the latest research is 8.5, so it's near enough.
So it's got it. Yeah.
I mean, so I'm luckier than the average, and that's still a terrible amount of time to wait.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned about that sort of getting the wrong, because I think you and I are almost sort of like opposite. So I was originally diagnosed with AS as a child, and then it turned into psoriatic arthritis, or a subtype of JA of psoriatic arthritis, and yours was almost the other way. So I can relate to that feeling. How did you process that? Like, because we've had people here that have sort of welcomed knowing what they're dealing with. I've had other people that have said when the diagnosis changes, it kind of fuels that sort of like fraud you can sometimes feel with like conditions that are sometimes a bit invisible and that sort of thing. So how did that feel, and how did you handle that?
I'd say, I mean, the initial diagnosis, the rheumatoid arthritis diagnosis, I think because it'd been quite a few months where I'd been saying, is it something, you know, longer term? And they've been saying, no, it's not. it came as a real shock when I just went to a checkup and they went, oh, we're diagnosing you with this. So that, especially at the age of 20, it was a massive shock. And I was typically, it was the one appointment I'd gone to on my own as well. So I remember that being quite traumatic. But once I'd got my head around it and started processing it, I found it better. Obviously, I didn't want to have something long term, but it was better having that initial diagnosis. So I could kind of go into action mode and think, right, what can I do? Like, what's the first step? How do I, you know, start living with this? And even when the diagnoses changed, so I was diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis when I changed hospital, when I moved back home from university. And then it was only after a few years where I'd been saying, it really, I think my symptoms are AS. You know, when I look at the symptoms of AS, it's literally like tick boxes. So it's only when I got a second or third opinion that they did all the investigations and said it was that. And I think it was a combination of relief at being like, okay, I'm not, you know, I'm not making this up in my head. I'm not trying to have a condition that I don't actually have. But then it was also that thing of, oh, damn, I wish they'd just gone, no, you don't have anything actually.
Yeah. It's always that catch right too. And we get it a lot on like our Discord and in the sort of support groups that we run and everything, where like you'll have some people that are desperate to just get a name, get something. Then you've got other people that are like, I don't know, almost like, I'm just going to hope I don't hear nothing. But then you're still stuck with the issue. So I know for me personally, it helped to know what I was dealing with. But also there's that bit of your brain that thinks by getting a label, it's going to get fixed. And then it's almost like the next chapter, isn't it? You get the diagnosis and then it's right. Okay. But overnight that changes nothing. It's now like, right, how do we tackle it? So once you knew what you were dealing with and, you know, sticking to the sort of AS element here, and maybe if, I've realized we've made some assumptions, people knowing what we're talking about here, Vaya. So maybe you can incorporate a little bit into the answer about, you know, the condition itself. How long did it then take for you to get some sort of control? If it is controlled in your mind, you know, for it to get to a place where it's something you could sort of live with. Sorry, that's a big question, but
I'll try and do that step by step. So just in a nutshell, ankylosing spondylitis, it comes under the umbrella name axial spondyloarthritis or axial spa. And it's essentially a type of inflammatory arthritis that primarily affects the spine, but also you can get inflammation where any muscles or tendons or ligaments are attaching onto bones. So you can get pain all over the body. You can get inflammation in the eyes, in the gut and things like that. So it's relatively common. It affects 1 in 200 adults in the UK, but as we mentioned, it takes a long time to get diagnosed, and particularly because there's this real misconception that it's a condition that only affects men, because in the past you could only be diagnosed with an x-ray and men are much more likely to get changes to their joints that you can see on an x-ray. So it's only in more recent years now that we've got MRI, we're actually picking women up a lot earlier, and men who have the inflammation before they have any of those joint changes. So it's definitely looking more hopeful. I'd say for me, it took a good year to really kind of get the condition under control once I'd got that initial diagnosis, because before I'd got the correct diagnosis, they were giving me all the medications for things like psoriatic arthritis and rheumatoid. So they weren't working. So yeah. I was put onto one of the biologic medications, which was like a wonder drug for me. It was fantastic. Unfortunately, I think a few people might relate that I was then switched to the biosimilar and it then lost its effect, which doesn't happen often, but yeah, we won't get into that. That will take up a whole chat.
And the community here is so bored to hit me telling that story, because essentially that event is what started my advocacy journey. So sorry to hear that you experienced that as well.
Yeah, and it has been a bit hit and miss. I've tried a couple of medications since, and the one I'm on now, it does seem to be helping, definitely. But I've got some of those structural changes to my joints that I know aren't going to get better. So I'm dealing with that pain alongside then the inflammatory pain. So it's a bit of a learning curve, kind of trying to manage both pains and doing the right thing for both.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said about how the diagnosis is changing. And because like I was brought up in that era, you know, sort of 15, 20 years ago, where it was very much marketed to me that it was very much a male thing. And there's lots of other sort of autoimmune conditions that are sort of the other way statistically. I didn't actually realize that was what changed. It was the imaging techniques and everything. So, yeah, so I've learned something new every day. So thank you for sharing. I should also probably point out, we're not going to go into detail on it, but the reason Zoe is so amazingly brilliant at sharing this information is because of what you do sort of in your line of work, isn't it? I don't know if you just want to maybe explain that very briefly.
Absolutely. So I'm really lucky that I now actually work for NASS, which is the National Axial Spondyloarthritis Society. So I head up the supported self-management program, which is basically all about creating what I would have hoped to have seen kind of back when I was originally diagnosed, all that support that we want and that peer support as well, trying to really embed that in the services that the charity provide. And funnily enough, it was actually through COVID that I started working for them, because I obviously at the start of COVID with no PPE and things like that, had to stop working as an osteopath. And then I started doing work just a few hours a week on the helpline and running Facebook Lives for them. And it's just evolved from there, because obviously, like what you do, it's just amazing to be able to chat to other people in a similar boat. So, yeah, I now work full time for them, which is really helpful for my joints as well.
Yeah, that's amazing to have that lived experience in such a key role. And if guys, if you're watching this live or watching this back, if you haven't checked out Zoe's Facebook Lives, then please do over in the NASS. Just search NASS on Facebook and I'm sure it will come up. Yeah, because they're brilliant and really insightful. So I want to talk more about, you know, how it's affected your career and everything, but I feel like before we get to that point, we should probably cover off some of the other conditions. So after the I'm trying to not make this sound complicated, but I know in your shoes, based on my own personal experience, it is like there's lots of layers to these things. So what happened after the AS? Was there some overlap? I know it didn't come along in nice neat boxes, I'm sure it didn't, but how did that sort of like transpire to get to your other diagnoses?
Yeah, so I had the diagnosis of hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos before the AS, and that was again through me kind of pushing for that diagnosis, because it was essentially, as I was growing up as a child, I would get injured frequently, and I look back at photos of myself and I don't know how my parents didn't think there's something really wrong when you see my elbow bending backwards and things like that. But it was essentially when I was at university and we were learning about these types of connective tissue disorders that it's classed as, that I went, oh, that explains like why everything hurts. So I got that diagnosis, and that definitely blurred things. Then when I started getting the inflammatory symptoms, it was really easy for people to put that down to the hypermobility, but unfortunately it wasn't related. But yeah, so there's a bit of an overlap with the symptoms there. And luckily for both conditions, like being active is the best thing for them as well.
Sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, did that when that, especially with something like AS, that is very much sort of perceived as being something that makes you very rigid and, you know, mobility limit, and which it does. How did the EDS work with that? Did that mask some of those symptoms?
Absolutely. So one of the classic tests is being able to touch the floor. So when you're standing, reaching down, touching your toes or touching the floor. And before I had the symptoms of AS, I could literally just bend down, put my palms just flat on the floor because I was hypermobile. And then after I started getting the symptoms and my back was stiffening up, I could still get my fingertips to the floor. So doctors would do that test and they'd be like, great, you can touch the floor. It's not something like AS, but I had to keep saying, yeah, but for me, that's stiff. For me, you know, I used to be able to go way further. Like, that's not right for me. Definitely blurred. And I have spoken to other people with hypermobility and AS who have said exactly the same thing, particularly for women, where, you know, it is deemed less common. We've had that same kind of experience.
And I'd say that it's hard, especially with like the medication stuff, because I know from my personal experience, not being able to sort of pinpoint what's doing what's helping what until something gets taken away or whatever, just makes it really complicated. So I can't imagine, like, I don't know, has you have that experience where, so for me, I always find that everything I get that's new, a new symptom gets sort of attributed to my long-term health condition, like by default. You must get that all the time, surely. You have multiple conditions.
Absolutely. And I'm lucky that where I live now, I've got a really good GP who knows me well, and he's happy when I come in and have done my own research and said, you know, oh, it doesn't seem like it fits all my other conditions, or, you know, or it might be this, it might not. So it's been really helpful that I've got someone that I feel like I'm kind of working with, which I think when you've got a lot of chronic health conditions, you know your conditions, you know your body. So being able to combine that with their expertise is the best thing, really.
Yeah. And obviously being like, medical professional, And I don't know the timeline, so feel free, like I said, to incorporate that in your answer. But did you find like being able to advocate for yourself? Because you've mentioned several times already that you pushed and you suggested or you highlighted. So, yeah, obviously that played a part, but just how important did you think that was? And also, I suppose, how do you think that, you know, maybe then affects people that don't have that ability to maybe join the dots or advocate themselves for themselves?
Absolutely. I think having some of that medical knowledge was really helpful kind of throughout my experiences, because I was able to communicate in a way that that healthcare professionals understand as well. So I think that definitely gives me a big help with that. I would say, I mean, my biggest tips are not to be afraid to Google, you know, obviously using reputable sources and getting the right information. But, you know, you know your body, you may well find something that you go, oh my God, that just ticks the boxes. You know, that sounds exactly like what I'm experiencing. Always prepare for appointments and write things down. So you want to kind of write down the key things you want to talk about, what you want to get out of the appointment. And I'll go in and I'll put it on the desk in front of me and be like, I'm going to work through these questions in the appointment. You know, I'm not leaving till we've gone through this. But the biggest thing I found is taking someone with me, because sometimes I do still find that, you know, particularly I'm aware that healthcare professionals are really busy. They're really stretched. So I feel like, oh, I should rush through it. And sometimes I won't have got through all of my list. But if I've got someone there with me, they'll be going, have you got through all your list? And they'll make sure I do. So I think that can be really helpful if you can take a friend, family member, someone who kind of will back you up if you need it, but also give you that nudge to make sure you're getting everything from the time that you can.
You know, that's such a good piece of advice. I was literally speaking to a doctor last year about asking them, why is there only one seat in the way in the doctor's office? Because, like, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but psychologically that already like sends, I walk around, if I've got my wife with me or whatever, it's already sending the message that we don't want a crowd. And for some of us, especially if you're in a really bad flare and your mental health is dipping, you know, you need that person to to give. And I think the really key word, point you said there, was to give you a nudge, because, you know, as somebody that grew up with a lot of this stuff when I was a kid, I had a lot of times where people were talking for me, and that was just as negative as not being able to sort of get everything out myself. So yeah, I think the way you worded that answer is great advice, because that is having that person that will sort of hold your hand through it and prompt you, not talk for you, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So you're getting what you want, you know, you've got that support, and even having those conversations beforehand, being like, you know, when we're in there, this is what would be really helpful if you could do, or, you know, keep quiet but just be present, however works best for you.
Yeah, totally. No, that's really good, really good advice. And it is something that I'm like a massive hypocrite. I'm like, I call myself an advocate and I do this stuff and we have these conversations. I turn into an absolute mouse in my appointment. Like, I don't know if I've had the same medical professional since I was a child and they're a bit like a father figure or whatever, but yeah, I always feel like the biggest hypocrite. So yeah, I need to start making a list, because everyone keeps telling that every time we ask that question, people say, make a list or bring someone with you. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. So the next bit, I suppose, I wanted to talk about is, before we get onto maybe some of the advocacy stuff and the amazing stuff you do now and what sort of prompted that, because I think I've probably got the order right anyway, just from personal experience, how has your condition impacted not only like how you want to live your life, but also working? You mentioned you know you went to work for NAS and it was during the pandemic and everything. So, you know, how has your condition impacted your career and also them sort of like the things you want to do with your life?
Yeah, it has massively impacted it. And particularly because I only got the symptoms while I was training to be an osteopath. And when you come out of training, you know, you're a qualified osteopath, you've got a few options, and most of them are, you know, you're working either in a clinic or you're working for yourself, and it's really physical and hands-on. And I mean, the main reason I went into that sort of career was because I wanted something where I could help people and where I could spend lots of time with people. So I wanted that kind of, in the private clinic, you know, you can run over if you need to, you can book people a longer slot if you need to take that time. So I really like that. But I found with my conditions, I mean, when I first came out of uni, I'd literally work 2 or 3 half days a week and then spend the rest of my time recovering. I lived with my parents, you know, for a good few years. I was really lucky that they were able to have me, and so that enabled me to work. But I think if I'd have been trying to live independently, I wouldn't have been able to work at all. So I was lucky then that over a few years I was then able to work pretty almost full time, so up to 4 days a week, and live, you know, away from home as well. But then I did find, I think it was more as I was getting those structural changes that I mentioned in my joints, and also my fatigue as well, because I experienced a lot of fatigue that just in the end, I just found even, you know, cutting down my working hours, I couldn't work enough to kind of then earn enough to pay my bills and to live. And then I had no life outside of work either. So yeah, I had to look at other options, and I was already actually looking at working for a charity like NASS when the pandemic hit. So I was lucky in terms of timing that then it meant I could transition into that, particularly with working from home. So that's really helped. But I think mentally it's really hard when you have to change career or have to change kind of life plans because of your condition. And that it is really tough. And people still now, they really mean well, but they'll still go, oh, do you miss it? Because they think I just went, oh, I don't fancy being an osteopath, I'm going to go and work for a charity. So yeah, they mean well, but it is really hard because it's like, yeah, I do miss it. You know, it's what I love doing, but I love what I do now as well. But it wasn't 100% my choice, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter how passionate you are about that. Like, I've been really fortunate to do stuff in this space and everything, and it's amazing. But I will always tell people I would drop it. It sounds really horrible, but I'm an honest guy and I'm going to say it anyway. I would drop, you know, all of this stuff, advocacy stuff, in a heartbeat if I could play rugby with my mates again or play in a band again. And I don't, you know, because that was my choice and that was who I felt I was before the condition changed my options. And you've encapsulated my experience absolutely perfectly there. So I'm sorry you can relate to that. And people don't appreciate like that grief thing, do they? So every time somebody will say like, oh, why did you stop it, or do you not want to do that anymore, it just, for me anyway, I don't know what your experience is, it just triggers, you know, it's sort of like a step back, then you've got to try and work through that sort of mental battle again. Do you have sort of similar experiences?
Absolutely. And particularly if it's someone that I don't know particularly well, I don't really want to say, oh, it's because of my conditions and because I'm disabled. And, you know, you don't want to get into all of that. So it's really hard kind of not lying, you know, giving an honest answer and just saying, you know, well, I transitioned and, you know, I do miss it, you know, to an extent, but I love what I do now. It is really tough. And it definitely takes you back to that kind of feeling in your gut of like, oh, you know, wasn't my choice, unfortunately.
And so you obviously do way more than just like the day job. I know you're a massive source of support for me during the pandemic and that period where people were sort of starting to share their stories a little bit more openly on social media. And also it was very weird to find out how close you are to me in my neck of the woods, the whole internet to lean on. And it turns out we're like stone's throw away. So, so, you know, that period and sort of finding your voice and sharing your story and everything, you know, most people say it helps them cope. Was that the same for you? And or were there other reasons that why you went into that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's weird. It's kind of an accident, really, because I started teaching other healthcare professionals about axial spa to begin with, because I was thinking there's a real gap, particularly osteopaths. You know, we're taught a fair amount about it at university, but not, you know, as in depth as we need, really, if you're going to be seeing people with the condition. So I kind of started from that way, and then I kind of fell into the advocacy through kind of being invited to speak and share my delayed diagnosis story at Parliament with NASS, their all-party parliamentary group. And then from there, it kind of snowballed, and I've kind of brought it more into what I do with NASS now as well, because at first I was kind of mainly there as a healthcare professional, but I found that I definitely get a lot out of kind of sharing my experiences in order to then talk to other people about, you know, their experiences as well. Particularly, we run some online group sessions as well. And I think it's really helpful that in that I bring my own experiences in as well and say, you know, I'm teaching about this, but, you know, I have it as well. I can empathize. And also I won't have all the answers because, you know, it is tough to live with. So, I can't remember what your exact question. I've kind of rambled now.
There were some amazing achievements in there, especially about sharing your story with Parliament and everything. But yeah, that you know, that whole, and many people say about getting into advocacy, it was a bit of an accident. Like I've already admitted earlier that I probably wouldn't be doing all, I know I wouldn't have done all this if I didn't feel I was backed into a corner and all other options were shut off. And I didn't know if there was an element of that, or if you generally just saw a gap. And it sounds like you had the skills as well, but obviously you're clearly brilliant at talking and sharing your story and how you come across, which helps. So yeah, it's just sort of unpicking how you found yourself in this. I think you answered it perfectly, thank you.
Oh, that's good. I would add though that although I kind of fell into it accidentally, and I keep doing it because I get the value from it and I can see other people do, but I still find it very scary, like even chatting, you know, and we know each other. It's still scary, like each time I do it. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I was pacing around the house for like 2 hours tonight before we started, and I do this all the time. Just because, I don't know, it's still, it doesn't matter what level you do it on, it's still a very personal thing. And and again, another example of me being a hypocrite, I'll often, people will say to me, how do I get into it or whatever, and I just say, share your story, no one can dispute your truth and all that. So I say all these things to help people do it, and then I still feel very vulnerable at times. It doesn't matter what level you do it on, you know, and I think a lot of us are sort of like accidental advocates. I think we all have skills that we would have, you know, so for example, I lean on my writing stuff, and you know, you've got your medical background and everything. I think we've all got these skills that we used to pull together to amplify our story. But I think many of us don't feel like we'd be here. So if we didn't sit in school, hope, but nobody sits in school wanted to be an advocate.
So, oh God, I used to even just dread having to put my hand up, let alone speak in front of people.
That's it, you know. And unfortunately, you have to have those lived experiences in order to do what we do. So thank you for doing such amazing stuff. I'd like, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit more, like, because you mentioned earlier about, you know, being disabled, and it is a term that we don't get on here very often with long-term health conditions, you know. It was a term that I found very hard to use for a lot of years, and only sort of now recently sort of felt comfortable doing it. And I know you sort of like quite openly, and you share on social media everything about the use of mobility aids, and which is amazing. Do you want to talk a little bit about your journey? Did you have those similar sort of things, or was it just something you embraced and felt really comfortable with from day one? And maybe some of the experiences you've had as a younger person, you know, using mobility aids and this sort of thing?
Absolutely. I appreciate you using the word younger. Thank you.
You certainly are.
Yeah, I definitely, it took a long time for me to kind of identify as disabled, and it sounds really strange, but it took a long time for me to realize that I am disabled. I don't know. I think a lot of us can have those kind of, you know, thoughts in our head. When you live with an invisible condition and an invisible disability, it can be really hard to know and to realize, oh, actually it is termed as that. And it was mainly when I was reading about the social model of disability that I really started understanding it. So the social model is talking all about the fact that the condition or the impairment isn't the thing that puts those barriers in place, it's society. So like a practical example is that I love going for walks in nature, but I have to take rests quite often. And there's a lot of places that have no seats anywhere to stop and rest. So that's the barrier to me being able to do that activity that I love. So then when I bought a stick, which folds out into a seat, that took away that barrier. So it wasn't my condition that was stopping me doing it. Obviously, there are still some things that I think no matter how many adaptations I had, I still wouldn't be able to do it. So then that is my condition. But on the whole, it was looking at, okay, it's, you know, it's this condition that I have, and then there's the barriers in society, and how can I overcome those? And I think that's what then made me more passionate about identifying as disabled, and then also sharing that with people, because I think there are so many of us who, when we can't do something, we just beat ourselves up about it. Whereas I think when you put it into those terms and you look at those barriers, and then you can look at, right, how can I overcome them? And I think mobility aids are a really big one that a lot of us shy away from at first. But I think, you know, there are some things that can be such a huge help that we think, you know, are we disabled? Are we disabled enough to use these? You know, it's really tough. And there wasn't much information out there kind of at the time to really, really help with that thought process and that understanding.
And I think, you know, for me anyway, it's like sometimes for me, it's like a conversation starter, and sometimes I don't want to have that conversation. So on those days where I'm struggling and I do have to get, so I have like a retractable kind of stick, cane, whatever you want to call it. And there are occasions where I have to use it, particularly if I don't trust my knee and it doesn't feel very strong. I walk my dog a lot of miles. The last thing my other half needs is to come and pick me up, and that has happened numerous times. But that, you know, sometimes, I don't know, it's a conversation prompt that you don't want, because if you're like me and you've had that background of playing lots of sport, or last week you were fine and this week you're not, you know, sometimes I don't want my family asking me why you got the stick today. Or, and I even had it with my last medical appointment. I needed it on the last in-person medical appointment I had in the middle of the pandemic. And as I'm going out of the door, I'd had my appointment, as I'm going out the door, the doctor said, "Why have you got that?" And I literally, like, of all the ways you could have phrased it, with my little built-in disability, you know, guilt and invisible illness guilt that many of us sort of have, that we've talked a lot about on this show, it was literally the worst way you could have phrased it, because, you know, you basically are already planting that seed that I shouldn't be using it. And so for me, it's that, ironically, I'm looking at the conversation changes lives at the bottom corner. For me, on that occasion, it's a conversation I don't want to have, that I then find myself not using it, and then I end up getting worse. Have you sort of encountered, I'm sure you've had negative experiences. We've all had negative experiences, whether that's asking for somebody to give up a seat on a bus or whatever. But have you had that sort of similar experience, or for you, it was like, I need it, I'm going to use it sort of thing?
No, even now, like, I've been using them for quite a few years now, and even now I'm walking down the street and someone's looking at me and I think, oh God, are they trying to work out what's wrong with me or why I need it? Yeah, still encounter that. And even particularly because a lot of the work that I do with other organizations as well is all online. So even if people know I have a condition, they don't necessarily know, most of the time they see me like this. So I even had something where, I was at a work event, not an ass event, but at a different work event. And someone who I literally just met went in front of loads of people. Oh, you've got a stick. What problem do you have? And I was like, well, firstly, I don't owe you my medical history, but also like wording it like that is just, yeah. And it's one of those things that I think even when it has happened a few times, I never really have anything ready to say. And it just puts that, I don't know, that feeling of either feeling like you have to be telling people and kind of validating yourself to them. It has that feeling where it's like you owe them, your medical history, your explanation, which you absolutely don't. And also just, yeah, it makes me feel really othered because I was there in a work capacity, in a professional capacity, and then they kind of make it about my disability. And it's like, yeah, it's very difficult. I still get those issues and those feelings. So
I have massive anxiety about it. And I'll say that whole starting a conversation I don't want to have. It's literally, even if I'm just walking my dog on a Sunday morning, no one's going to see me. Just walking out the door, I'm worried about neighbours looking out the window. And it's absolutely stupid. We shouldn't feel like that. But unfortunately, our previous experiences lead us to feel like that. Like I say, that doctor, I've got to suddenly justify whilst I'm using it when we'd spent the last, all of our 10 minutes you get in a year to talk, explaining that things weren't managed at the minute. So I felt like I'd already answered the question. And you're still getting asked specifically why. And it's just, it just feeds into that whole guilt, fraud, lots of themes that we've talked about on here. Like I say, our conditions aren't invisible, but people know what I mean when I say that term, especially if someone with psoriatic arthritis, a lot of my condition isn't invisible, but there are elements people don't see. It's just really difficult and just puts a massive spotlight on you, doesn't it? When I think until we get to that point where people just accept it and see you as that person, and nothing else attached, or what you're using, or whatever, then we've still got work to do.
Absolutely.
And so, did you are you sort of finding like, is your condition? I'm not going to make assumptions here. Like, is your condition sort of like a progressive one? Is it one that you're expecting to have to use them sort of things more as you get older, or? What's the sort of outlook for you, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, of course. With AS, with axial SpA, it's really unpredictable. So there are some ways that you can tell whether the condition is going to progress. So technically it is a progressive condition. You can get joint changes and eventually your joints and your bones can fuse together, particularly in the spine and in the pelvis. But the degree to which that happens to each person is very different. So for men, it is more common. So, I've got better odds being female, but I do already have some of those bony changes in my pelvis and in my mid back. So it's one of those difficult things that I think a lot of us have to live with, that uncertainty as well. So even when you know you've got a progressive condition, you don't know how it's going to impact you. So I can say that I've had some impact, but I've had it 12 years and not particularly well controlled. So I think the changes I've had aren't as bad as a lot of people have, definitely. But yeah, it's very unpredictable. And I think that's a big thing that we kind of learn to accept and cope with, kind of even on a day-to-day basis, that unpredictability.
And do you struggle? We don't talk enough about the mental. I know I do. I never shut up about it. But we don't talk in the community and medical community and everything about the mental health impact of, living with that, not knowing what that tomorrow looks like and the ups and downs. And then you've talked about the biosimilar and it feels like the rug's pulled from under you. And I know we haven't I haven't sort of run this by you in advance, so if you're not happy talking about the sort of mental side of it, then please don't. But is that something you've dealt with or you continue to deal with, and how does that impact your sort of ability to manage the condition as a whole?
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk about it because, as you say, it's something that I think as a community as a whole, we don't talk about as much. Definitely has had a massive impact on my mental health. And it's something that I think I'll always be managing and always be kind of developing ways to cope with as well, particularly as the condition changes over time too. But actually, most recently, I saw an occupational therapist, and that was really helpful for me because I'd recently had a family bereavement, and I'd mentioned that to her, and she kind of brought in the whole kind of family bereavement side of things and coping with grief into my condition as well. And that was really helpful because it was looking at kind of, I think it was kind of just having someone external, you know, even though I know that it's normal to feel down or feel anxious about your condition or feel scared of the future, having someone else say that to me and then say this is completely normal and these are ways that we can help cope with those emotions, that was so helpful. So I definitely recommend, I think it's talking about it more and talking to other people and realizing this is completely normal to feel like this, and you know, one day you'll probably be coping a lot better than another, and that's also normal. It's just finding what works for you to cope on those harder days and focusing on getting back to the better days, but not feeling that pressure too either.
Two brilliant lines, Zoe. Thank you for that. It's so true though, and there is hope, guys, for anyone who's watching this either live or back. The stuff that's coming out of like social prescribing and the multidisciplinary approaches you're seeing, like what initially used to only be like the pain management side of things, is now being adopted a lot wider. So we're heading in the right direction, and that combined with like patient initiated follow-ups and all this sort of thing, there is hope, guys, on this. Me and Zoe just went through our conditions in a period where a lot changed, and then you stick a pandemic on top. So I'm always conscious to caveat what we say with that, because I appreciate we got the rough end of the wedge for a lot of our experiences. So in terms of, you know, what's next for Zoe, advocacy, career, or what you'd like you already do so many amazing things, and I feel really bad that we probably haven't given you enough credit for all the sort of like roles, positions and panels and things you sit on and hold. Like, you do amazing things, so feel free to drop them in now. But what's next for you, or what do you hope to do going forwards?
So my main thing, well, work-wise, is with NASS we're launching a new sort of strand of our supported self-management program. So we're launching a whole new area which is going to be really helpful for people newly diagnosed or for people kind of on their journey of axial SPA who need that extra support and need that extra information. And we're launching kind of monthly meetings and, you know, meetups for people online as well. So trying to build that real kind of community of support, like I said near the beginning, kind of creating what I would have really benefited from back when I was first dealing with the symptoms. So I'm really excited about the work side of things in developing that. In terms of my advocacy, at the moment it's kind of on the back burner a little bit because I'm dealing with this potential new condition. So for anyone watching, it's called POTS. So basically means that you kind of faint quite regularly when you're upright. So at the moment, I'm kind of seeing how that settles, seeing how, depending on how long it takes to get the actual diagnosis and treatment. And then the advocacy side, I think, is just going to be mainly probably writing about my experiences for a while, I think, so that it's a little bit easier as things are unpredictable at the moment.
Yeah, and I'm sorry you're going for that experience and you've got another potential thing coming on top of everything else you're dealing with. You really don't need that. But what I would say, like, from a positive point of view, it really comes across how passionate you are about what you do. Like, just when you're talking about that, your work and your work projects and things like that, you just see it on your face. So I'm so grateful that you've got that and something that you're passionate to work on. But also, as a member of the community, as a patient myself that have used sort of NASA's services for a long time and other organizations, it brings me so much hope seeing somebody with lived experience in your role doing the things that you're doing with Facebook Lives and the information and the awareness raising. So yeah, keep doing amazing things, Zoe, because as a patient we're all very, very grateful for that.
Oh, thank you.
I'm probably going to leave there. I'm conscious of your time. Please feel free to stick around and we can chat to the community that are watching this live. But before I let you go, where can people find you on social media if they want to either follow what you're doing or talk more?
Yeah, so on Twitter, I am Zoe Clark Osteo, and on Instagram, I'm Zoe the Osteo. So you're welcome to come and follow and chat on there. And you can always DM me if you want to sort of have a chat, you know, via email or something, if that's easier. I'm always happy to see if I can help.
Brilliant. And anyone who's, like I say, watching this back, I will put all of the links to that in the show notes so you can find Zoe. So Zoe, thank you so much for joining us. It's been brilliant. We could have gone twice as long, but I'm very conscious of time. And it's been a long while us two fitting this in around our health conditions and busy diaries. So I'm so glad we finally got to do it. And you're always welcome back anytime if you want to come back and share any news with us or anything you're doing regarding your work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I should also thank you for doing one of my Facebook Lives with me as well. That was a brilliant one.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that very much. So yeah, thank you for that. Great. Thanks, Zoe.